being undocumented, many being arrested, being deported, yes. And why you as a nurse decided this is your role, this is your job right sure. now.
Well, as a nurse in South Central LA, I see that my patients tell me that they are not coming to the hospital. They're scared. So there's implications that are broad and far-reaching. People are sicker. They're coming in and they're dying because they did not want to come to the hospital. They're coming to area. The ICE kidnappers are coming to areas that are supposed to be safe for us. We want to take care of our patients. And now people are sicker. They're not coming in. Our census has been down. Even the hospital has indicated that this is the case. So that's as a nurse, it's a solidarity, right? They're coming after people, but we're, the way that we're going to win, and we're organizing community patrols and fighting back, is through solidarity for all people. And it's my duty, and I'm very honored to be here with Union del Barrio and other organizations to organize. And like I said, we're growing. We encourage people to join the Community Self-Defense Coalition and other organizations.
Amanda, we're going to have to leave it there. Amanda Trebach is an ICU nurse, a member of Union del Barrio. She was detained by ICE for a day, violently detained. I'm Mimi Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will be held on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios in North Portland. At the annual meeting, members will have the opportunity to meet candidates running in the board election. Final votes will be cast and counted. The results of the elections will be announced at the end of the meeting. Online voting is open now through the annual meeting at kboo.fm/board25. Paper ballots will be sent to members by mail. Again, that's KBOO's annual meeting and board election on Saturday, September 20th at 11:30 a.m. at Mississippi Studios, located at 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/board25.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, critiques for Wilson's decision to cater to Trump's DEI mandate speak out. Trump is continuing to deploy more National Guard troops in D.C. And in international news, Mel Gertov breaks down Trump's meeting with Putin. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 19, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. Wilson's recent executive order to cater to Trump's DEI mandate is garnering controversy. After speaking with Wilson, Sam Sachs, who ran for city council last year, published some thoughts on the matter. Hanna Francis has more on the story.
Sam Sachs, former human rights commissioner for the city of Portland and founder of No Hate Zone, Sachs says he is concerned about the mayor's recent executive order to cater to the Trump administration's mandate against support for DEI. Sachs says in a recent opinion piece, quote, "Although I support Wilson, I am deeply troubled by his decision, which seems rushed and without care or consideration to the history of these initiatives. This includes the Charles Jordan Standard, a policy I helped author and that was brought forward by the late city commissioner, Nick Fish, in 2016, end quote. Now, he is calling for the mayor to pause his executive order and to have a work session and public comment period instead of making the call himself. Sam, thanks for being here. So, the Oregonian just published an opinion piece that you wrote. Will you tell me a little bit more about that?
Mayor Keith Wilson issued an executive order changing approximately 75 policies in the city. The wording to come into compliance with the Trump administration's, his executive order, I believe. And a lot of those initiatives have to do with DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. I actually spoke to Mayor Wilson, and I was informed that the Charles Jordan was one of those initiatives. And just for some history, I've been hearing rumors that this was coming down, but no one had contacted me or reached out to me on the record or made me aware of the Charles Jordan, that the Charles Jordan standard was going to be impacted by this executive order. There in the wind, but we are given the reassurance that diversity, equity, and inclusion is going to be, you know, still an important part of this administration, Mayor Wilson's, which I believe it will. But so I decided to write a piece pushing back, and I spoke to Mayor Wilson prior to writing this piece to let him know and to, you know, let him know I respect and appreciate him. I support him, but I disagree with this decision. And I think that that the city and the mayor should fight the Trump administration. And I also believe that there should be an open forum, public comment from the community, a work session, none of which has happened prior to issuing this executive order.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. How has your professional experience informed your opinion here?
Well, I've been in public safety for most of my life, but I've been doing racial justice for over 30 years. You know, I've worked with different organizations. I've lobbied the city, the county, and the state around this policy. Initially, in 2009, I was able to get the Oregon Rooney Rule passed into law, and then the Charles Jordan standard was adopted by the city, and then the Gladys McCoy standard. And all three policies do similar things. They require the interviewing of qualified minority candidates women or people with disability when hiring for leadership positions or coaching positions. So I've spent the last 30 years doing different work around racial justice. I worked on racial justice. I worked on the Oregon Native American mascot issue to eliminate the use of Native American mascots. I worked for Senator Avelle Louise Gordley in her last session as a senator in Oregon. So I have a lot of experience, education. I have a degree in Black Studies from Portland State University. So a lot of those things over the years have informed my my critique. You know, when the guy who authored one of the policies isn't even contacted, you know, where's the rest of the community in all of this? Where's their voice, especially those, you know, people of color who are going to be impacted by these policies?
And what do you hope to see from the city?
Well, my ultimate wish is that he would cancel the executive order altogether and tell the city attorneys to find out a way to fight back, because there is a way to fight back legally. The city attorneys don't want to take that route, it seems like. That'd be my ultimate, you know, hope, is that they would, you know, do that. Short of that, because I don't think that's going to happen, I would like for the mayor and the city council to hold a work session and discuss this issue. I'd like to have some public comment. The opening it up to the community to have a listening session or to hear from the community in public comment, and then deciding if he should continue with the executive order would be the right way to go. I'd like to see him pause the executive order now and put together a work session with city council and hear from the community before moving forward. I think that's the best way to approach this. And ultimately, you know, like I said in my letter, we have to continue to fight for the rights and freedoms of all people in the city, but specifically people of color, women, people with disability, LGBTQ. Diversity, equity, and inclusion is something we have to continue to fight for. We can't just give it away easily.
You've been listening to KBOO News. I'm Hannah Francis.
Donald Trump announced yesterday that he wants to end mail-in voting. Trump wrote in his social media account, in all capital letters, that mail-in ballots are a scam and that elections can never be honest while we have them. He said, without providing any evidence, that voting by mail leads to widespread fraud. Oregon and Washington have long used vote by mail in elections with no widespread evidence of abuse. In fact, an audit of years 2000 to 2019 by Oregon's Legislative Fiscal Office found there were approximately 61 million ballots cast. Of those, only 38 criminal convictions of voter fraud were obtained. Trump also vowed to get rid of voting machines and suggested only watermarked paper ballots. He pledged to sign an executive order related to voting before the midterm elections. Interestingly, the comments came after Trump arrived back in Washington, D.C. after meeting with Vladimir Putin to discuss Russia's war in Ukraine. Trump said Putin questioned the honesty of mail-in voting during that meeting. In response, U.S. Senator Ron Wyden posted on X, "Now Donald Trump is taking advice from Vladimir Putin on how to conduct elections," end quote. Oregon Secretary of State Tobias Reed also minimized the president's statements, saying Trump, quote, is clearly actively working to corrupt our elections. Reed said the federal government does not have the authority to end mail-in voting without an act by Congress. He says the Constitution is very clear that states run elections. Stopping the current system would disproportionately affect rural and elderly voters. Oregonian Republican leaders have pointed out the state's motor voter program, which automatically registers people to vote when they get a new driver's license, erroneously added more than 1,600 possible non-citizen voters to the list. Brock Smith noted that he had proposed two bills to change Oregon's voting laws during this year's legislative session, making in-person voting on the date of an election the standard method for conducting an election. Neither bill passed. A spokesperson for Governor Tina Kotek said, quote, Oregon's electoral system is one of the most secure, effective, and accessible in the nation. The governor will fight to protect the access to democracy that Oregon has celebrated for years, end quote. About 75% of registered Oregon voters returned their ballots during this year's general election, easily beating the national average of 64%. There are more than 3 million registered voters in Oregon. President Trump says he'll end mail-in voting before next year's midterm elections. With that story and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Democracy is the foundation of our country, and voting at home is a way to center the voter in that process. It's a way to maximize voter turnout and engagement.
Barbara Smith-Warner with the National Vote at Home Institute says states that automatically mail ballots to all eligible voters have significantly higher turnout. Nearly one-third of ballots cast in 2024 were mailed in. President Donald Trump calls it a scam and says he'll eliminate it by executive order before next year's midterms. With voting run by the states, it's not clear if he can. Texas Democratic legislators have returned after a two-week absence that prevented Republicans from passing new congressional maps. GOP Governor Greg Abbott has called a second special session to finish the mid-decade redistricting. And Speaker Dustin Burroughs says absent lawmakers continue to face civil arrest warrants.
We are done waiting. We have a quorum. Now is the time for action. We'll move quickly, and the schedule will be demanding until our work is complete.
The Democrats are declaring victory, saying they built a legal record to challenge any new map in court while inspiring California to redo its districts to offset Republican gains in Texas. At the White House, Trump, Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, and European leaders discussed swapping land for peace in a possible deal with Russia. Trump says he'll support NATO-like security guarantees for Ukraine and suggested U.S. troops could be deployed as part of a coalition. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says both sides will have to give and get.
You can't have a peace agreement unless both sides make concessions. That's a fact. That's true in virtually any negotiation.
Trump reportedly called Russian President Vladimir Putin during the meeting and said ceasefire and land swaps could be subject to future talks, including the Kremlin. GOP governors are sending more National Guard troops to Washington, D.C. to support the president's federal takeover of city policing and a crackdown on homelessness and street crime. About 900 Guard members from West Virginia, South Carolina, Mississippi, and Ohio should arrive this week. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser says they're not needed.
The question is really not for us. It's for why the military would be deployed in an American city to police Americans.
The right-leaning cable network Newsmax has agreed to pay nearly $70 million to settle a defamation lawsuit brought by Dominion Voting Systems. The company sued the channel for falsely claiming its voting machines rigged votes for President Joe Biden in 2020.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News in Depth. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be a high of 80 and a low of 60 degrees. And tomorrow it will be a high of 82 and a low of 54 degrees and partly cloudy. Today in history, in 1960, Russia launches Sputnik 5, the first spacecraft to carry animals into space and bring them back alive. Passengers include two dogs, a gray rabbit, 40 mice, two rats, and 15 flasks of fruit flies. The quote of the day is from Neil deGrasse Tyson. He said, quote, "The universe is under no obligation to make sense to you." A federal judge in Phoenix, Arizona, Friday, seemingly cleared the way for a massive copper mining project until the Ninth Circuit suddenly stepped in. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Friday, a federal judge in Phoenix seemingly cleared the way for a massive copper mining project until the Ninth Circuit suddenly stepped in. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the latest court order came less than 24 hours before Oak Flat inside the Tonto National Forest would have turned into private property.
That pending land exchange between the U.S. Forest Service and Resolution Copper has been put on hold once more, with a temporary administrative injunction issued Monday by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The new order comes after Judge Dominic Lanza denied requests to delay the congressionally authorized land transfer. These pleas came from plaintiffs, including the San Carlos Apache tribe. The tribe called it a last-minute victory, while Resolution Copper is confident the court will ultimately affirm Judge Lanza's, quote, well-reasoned orders. The three-judge panel would not comment on the merits, but noted these appeals will undergo an expedited briefing schedule starting next month. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
State lawmakers are holding a joint hearing Tuesday in Sacramento about the University of California holding Native American human remains and cultural items. Three state audits over the past 5 years show UC fails to return the remains. University officials are expected to respond. Summer is a prime time for gathering and baking camas across the Pacific Northwest, Rockies, and Plains regions. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports on a bake-off recently held outside Eugene, Oregon.
Celette's tribal member Joe Scott heads the Traditional Ecological Inquiry Program under the Long Tom Watershed Council. He described how he'd layer his packets of leaf-wrapped camas bulbs.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to throw the wet sword ferns on top of this. Bunch of water, like a couple of buckets of water after the maple leaves, and then a layer of these skunk cabbage leaves, put the packets on top of that, and then the alder and the ferns and all this stuff right here.
Oh, and there's mugwort, hazel, and bracken ferns in Scott's recipe too. The whole oven hissed with steam once the water hit the hot rocks. Nearby, the TIP senior intern and my kid, Samuel Bull of the Nez Perce tribe, assembled the second oven with mom's help. This was mostly ferns, maple leaves, and camas bumbled in skunk cabbage leaves, with some carrots and potatoes thrown in for experimentation's sake, all under canvas and four buckets of water.
Okay, that's good. Yes. I would put the camas closer to the middle.
Okay. Give those to Joe. Right there is great.
Is it cooking?
Yeah.
Let's start the steam. Flash forward to a day later. Bola decided to do a camas bake for 24 hours. The group peeled back the canvas to reveal glistening and translucent camas bulbs.
Looks good.
Look at those beauties.
Good?
It's really good.
Give me some flavor notes.
Really soft, sweet, starchy.
Perfect. I'm so happy.
Wow.
And yes, Bull's potatoes and carrots came out well too. Scott's batch baked for nearly 26 hours and had a small fire burning atop his oven for part of that time. At first, there was a little concern as some bulbs were hardened and dark, but then when the rest were unearthed,
they're perfect. They're like a sweet gumdrop.
The longer bake meant Scott's camas were more caramelized and sweeter. But at the end of the day, Scott said the real success of the event was creating community. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull, near Eugene, Oregon.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Orphan wells leave toxic legacy across Pennsylvania. The state has plugged hundreds of these unused wells, but thousands are still leaking dangerous chemicals and climate-warming methane. Dr. Anthony Lysowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lysowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Since Edwin Drake struck oil in Pennsylvania in 1859, hundreds of thousands of oil and gas wells have been drilled in the state. Many are now so-called orphan wells, wells that have been unused for decades but were never properly plugged and capped.
Some of the wells, because of their age, may only have a pipe sticking out of the ground.
Dan Cunahan is at Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection in the Bureau of Oil and Gas Operations. He says orphan wells can leak toxic chemicals into groundwater and emit methane, a potent global warming gas, into the atmosphere. So for decades, the state's been working to plug orphan wells, which involves placing cement at various depths to seal potential leaks. Funding from the federal bipartisan infrastructure law helped accelerate the effort. Over the past 2 years, Pennsylvania plugged more than 300 wells. That's more than they plugged in the entire decade prior. But it's still just a fraction of the orphan wells in the state.
We have documented over 27,000 abandoned and orphan wells that we have information for, we know the location of.
So there's much more work to do to fix the problem in Pennsylvania and beyond. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
President Trump is moving forward with his controversial fight against crime in the nation's capital this Monday. The administration is deploying an additional 1,250 troops from four Republican-led states. Mississippi, Ohio, South Carolina, and West Virginia will contribute to more than doubling the number of boots on the ground in D.C. as part of the president's federal takeover of the city. Notably, all troops are expected to soon carry weapons, reversing initial orders that mandated only body armor without firearms. These new deployments signal a significant escalation of the Trump administration's efforts to exert control over D.C. amid ongoing tensions with Mayor Bowser. In her response, Bowser stated, quote, "We don't have any authority over the D.C. Guard or any other guards, but I think it makes the point that this is not about D.C. crime. The focus should be on violent crime. Nobody is against focusing on driving down any level of violence. If this is really about immigration enforcement, the administration should make that plain," end quote. So far, the National Guard's presence has been described as low impact, primarily assisting with crowd control in areas like Union Station, the National Mall, and the Lincoln Memorial. Republican Governor Tim Reeves of Mississippi commented on the troop deployment, saying, quote, "Crime is out of control there, and it's clear something must be done to combat it," end quote. However, critics question whether this approach effectively addresses the issues at hand. While some states have answered the call for assistance, others, like Vermont, have opted out. Vermont Governor Phil Scott politely declined the request, with his chief of staff, Jason Gibbs, stating, quote, "While public safety is a legitimate concern, the governor does not support utilizing the Guard for this purpose and does not view the enforcement of domestic law as a proper use of the National Guard," end quote. Before the federal intervention, Washington, D.C. had seen a significant drop in crime since 2023. This takeover was initiated via an executive order declaring a, quote, crime emergency, end quote, in the Capitol. The Trump-Putin summit in Alaska was a disaster for the U.S., for Ukraine, and for Trump. He gave Putin exactly what Putin wanted: no ceasefire, no sanctions, and a pathway to annexing Ukrainian territory, all without providing for Ukraine's future security. Historians might regard the summit as Trump's Munich. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. President Trump emerged from a much shorter meeting than expected with Vladimir Putin in Anchorage to say that there was no deal, but an extremely productive meeting in which many points were agreed to. What points? Neither leader provided any details about the meeting, and Trump took no questions at the joint news conference with Putin. But plainly, Trump left empty-handed. "We didn't get there," he said. "There" should mean a ceasefire in Ukraine and sanctions on Russia, as Trump has said many times. But it is Putin who can say, "We got there," because Trump abandoned his previous positions, ones that the Europeans had agreed with, and accepted Putin's desire for acquiring all of the Donbas region of Ukraine, including land Russia does not occupy. Trump agreed to jump directly to peace talks without a ceasefire. This extraordinary surrender to Russia's ambitions constitutes the appeasement many observers, me included, had long feared. Gone were all the suspicions of Putin that Trump had said he had. "He's very nice to us all the time, but it turns out to be meaningless," he had said. And all the threats of serious consequences if Putin did not accept a ceasefire. Putin is trustworthy again, just as he was at Helsinki in 2018, when Trump said he trusted Putin more than he trusted his own intelligence community. We should have been prepared for this outcome to the summit. In the run-up to it, most Russia experts seemed to agree that Putin already had the upper hand. First, Trump had made a serious mistake in meeting with Putin, an indicted war criminal, on U.S. territory. The red carpet treatment for Putin sent entirely the wrong signal. As one commentator noted, Trump greeted Putin like an old friend and reliable ally. Second, Trump's apparent belief that a one-on-one meeting with Putin would yield favorable results was badly mistaken. Trump is no match for Putin in any give and take. And third, Trump and Putin have completely different goals. Max Boot, Washington Post opinion writer, wrote before the Anchorage meeting, quote, "The whole summit is built on a fundamental misunderstanding. Trump thinks Putin wants to end the war. What Putin really wants is to win the war," unquote. If Trump's turnabout holds, that's exactly what Putin will get. What was true before the Trump-Putin meeting remains true today. First, Putin has often stated his ambition to subordinate and eventually take over all of Ukraine, which he regards as an illegitimate state. U.S. policy under Trump has never taken that aim seriously. Timothy Snyder writes in his Substack column for August 14, quote, "Putin's utopia is one of a Ukraine with no government, with a population cowed by torture, with children stolen and brainwashed, with patriots murdered and buried in mass graves, with resources in Russian hands," unquote. And next, Trump has failed to hold Russia to account for any of its actions in Ukraine. His threats of sanctions have been ignored by Russia, and his appeal for a 30-day ceasefire has gone nowhere. Trump has lived up to his taco moniker with Putin. That is, Trump always chickens out. Nor has Trump ever mentioned Russian reparations for the hundreds of billions of dollars in economic losses suffered by Ukraine. Nor has he demanded Russia's return of kidnapped Ukrainian children, or an accounting for all the other war crimes committed by the Putin regime. To the contrary, Trump has terminated efforts at the Justice Department and the State Department to collect evidence of Russian war crimes. So here are my conclusions about the Alaska meeting. First, it was a disaster for Trump. He got played. His effort to flatter Putin with the location and the optics failed. Second, Putin was given no incentive to stop his war. To the contrary, Trump gave him every incentive to keep fighting. No demands of any kind and no leverage used, such as tariffs or sanctions, to make Putin stop and think. As former National Security Advisor Susan Rice said on MSNBC, Trump, quote, "let Putin out of the penalty box." Third, Ukraine is put in a very difficult position, though it has the backing of European leaders. Trump has abandoned any U.S. role in defense of Ukraine, leaving it to the other NATO members to provide military support. The next Trump-Putin meeting, with Zelensky in attendance, is slated to aim at a deal over Ukraine's territory. Trump said as much when he told Fox News Radio prior to the Alaska summit, quote, "The second meeting is going to be very, very important because that's going to be a meeting where they," meaning Putin and Zelensky, "make a deal. And I don't want to use the word divvy things up, but you know, to a certain extent, it's not a bad term, okay?" Imagine the scene. Trump accepts Putin's invitation to hold the next meeting in Moscow, at which Zelensky is put in the position, by Trump, of either agreeing to Putin's territorial demands or facing further destruction of Ukraine. Call it another Munich or another Yalta. Either way, it's a sellout of an independent country by a U.S. president who believes he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Mel Gertov, James Kemp, and Josh Salem. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lysowitz. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News.
The whole world is watching the genocide in Gaza, and local